As I said last time I had the opportunity to preach, it is always a great privilege to stand in this pulpit. The opportunity and the importance of it is not lost on me, especially growing up in this church and recognizing all these faces from when I was as old as Lucas and thinking, man, what does it look like to look out at everybody up from the pulpit? And it's not that great, Lucas, I gotta say. It's always a privilege. I appreciate each one of you that came out this evening after hearing me in Sunday school. So at least you guys valued Sunday school enough to go, well, we'll go ahead and hear this guy talk again this evening. It is not my intention to actually keep us here the entirety of the length of this service. As Pastor always says, when you let people know that they're getting out early, it helps them pay attention. So we will test that theory and see how well it works. By way of introduction, I just want to let you guys know that the title of this message is Be a Man. And it is absolutely a challenge to the men of this church. It certainly was a challenge for me as I was preparing for it, and a challenge for me over the past really several months, just as I have been maybe coming to terms is a bit of an extreme phrase, but coming to terms with fatherhood and maturing as a husband and, thinking back on my past and things that I wish I would have done differently, things that I wish I would have been able to do better, but then looking forward and understanding the great burden that's a blessing, but a burden that's been placed on me now to raise my own son as my father raised me to be a man of God. And so what I'm bringing to you guys is really something that God has laid on my heart personally, but that I hope that it would be a blessing to you as well. So this is, of course, a challenge for the men in the room, but certainly a challenge for the women as well to be holding those men in your life accountable, whether it's your father, your brothers, your sons, that these are the expectation that God has of each one of us as men. Being raised as an unruh, most of you can kind of imagine what that's like. Each one of my uncles is pretty much as close to the quintessential American man's man as you can get. It's all about football. It's all about cars. It's about talking about each of those things at length. It's about numerous farming analogies, which most of you are very familiar with. Here at Westside. I don't think I will actually personally delve into my own farming experience, so I'll just go ahead and leave those analogies to Pastor. But that really is and was my experience as an unruh growing up. I had some amazing masculine male role models in my life, Pastor Unruh being one of them. And I still consider him basically second to my dad as that male role model of here's how you're supposed to act as a father, as a husband, as a Christian man. But my dad would always give me a really hard time growing up because I wanted to be that unruh man. That was all my goal in life. I wanted to be the biggest Nebraska football fan. I wanted to be the automotive mechanic like my dad was. I wanted to follow him around when he was at home. He worked such long hours, but when he was home, when he's changing oil on vehicles, when he's mowing the lawn, all of those things, I wanted to do all the things that he did. And I'm thankful that I had that spirit and that my mom encouraged me to do that because my dad really wanted to invest time into me and my brothers so that we would grow up as men. But he would rib us a lot. So he would see me and my brother struggling to do something, whether it's getting the oil plug off of a vehicle or struggling to open a can of something. And he would ask us, do you need a man to do that? And of course, at that point, being 10, 11, 12 years old, and all you want in life is to be a man, that sure just cuts you to the quick because, no, Dad, I am a man. I can open my own jar of pickles. But it wasn't just those things. And it wasn't just the ribbing. It was, now let me show you how to do this. And let me show you how a man handles a situation. So I appreciate that about my dad a lot, and there's probably going to be more times than I even have written down on my outline that I refer back to him because he was and is the best role model I think a young man could ever have. I would like to start in with a scripture reading. So if you would turn to 2 Samuel 23, we're going to start in verse 8. This is one of my favorite passages of the Old Testament, being someone who is very interested personally in history. The Old Testament, and specifically 2 Samuel, is fantastic. I love reading about all the stories of David and how he fought against the Philistines, and of course the story of David and Goliath, and just kind of picturing in my head, because unfortunately we don't have any audio or video recording of what that was like back then, just picturing in my head what that scene must have looked like to see thousands of Israelites charging against the Philistines after David defeats Goliath. So, and this is another one of those passages when Pastor would read when I was young, I'd always picture all of these mighty men of Israel and these great feats. So let's start in verse 8 and read about them. These be the names of the mighty men whom David had. The Tachmonite, who sat in the seat chief among the captains. The same was Adino the Eznite. He lifted up his spear against 800, whom he slew at one time. And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite, one of the three mighty men of David, when they defied the Philistines that were gathered together to battle, and the men of Israel were gone away, he arose and smote the Philistines with his hand until his hand was weary and his hand clave unto the sword. And the Lord wrought a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to spoil. And after him was Shammah, the son of Agee, the Hararite. And the Philistines were gathered together in a troop where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. And the people fled from the Philistines. But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it and slew the Philistines. And the Lord wrought a great victory. And three of the 30 chief went down and came to David in the harvest time unto the cave of Adullam. And the troop of the Philistines pitched in the valley of Rephaim. And David was then in a hold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David longed and said, "Oh, that one would give me a drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." And the three mighty men brake through the host of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink thereof, but poured it out unto the Lord. And he said, "Be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is this not the blood of the men that went in jeopardy of their lives?" Therefore, he would not drink it. These things did these three mighty men. And Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief among three, and he lifted up his spear against 300 and slew them, and had the name among three. Was he not most honorable of three? Therefore he was their captain, howbeit he attained not unto the first three. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done many great acts, he slew two lion-like men of Moab. He went down also and slew a lion in the midst of the pit in time of snow, and he slew an Egyptian, a goodly man, and the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a staff and plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and slew him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and had the name among three mighty men. He was more honorable than the 30, but he attained not to the first three, and David set him over his guard. Asahel, the brother of Joab, was one of 30. Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem, Shammah the Heradite, Elika the Heradite, Helez the Paltite, Ira the son of Ikesh the Tekoite, Abiezer the Anethothite, Mebunai the Hushathite, Zalman the Ohohite, Maharai the Netophathite, Helib the son of Bana the Netophathite, Itai, the son of Ribai, of Gibeah, of the children of Benjamin, Benaiah, the Pirathonite, Hiddai, of the brooks of Gash, Abi-Albon, of Arbathite, Asmaveth, the Barhumite, Eliba, the Shalbanite, of the sons of Jashan, Jonathan, Shammah, the Hararite, Ahiam, the son of Sharar, the Hararite, Eliphelet, the son of Ahazbi, the son of the Makathite, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite, Hezri, the Carmelite, Parai, the Arbite, Egal, the son of Nathan of Zobah, Bani, the Gadite, Zelek, the Ammonite, Naharai, the Berothite, armor-bearer to Joab, the son of Zeruiah, Ira, the Ithrite, Gareb, an Ithrite, Uriah, the Hittite, 30 and 7 in all. I'm sure Pastor is going to listen to the recording of this and go, he did not get any of those names right. But I did read this in advance so that I would be prepared because I knew there were a lot of names. In reading specifically, of course, just the long list of names there at the bottom, but of the actual acts of these men, one is sobered to realize what they actually stood up against. And one of the reasons that this topic of being a man is such a burden on me is because I am simply not sure at this point in our Christian history how many of these men we have left. And it's really depressing if you think about it. How many men do you believe would stand up in the face of such an outnumbered foe, take no care for their own life, stand up and do the right thing, and even in this case use violence and use might, the power of their own hand, to, as this passage say, allow the Lord to provide a great victory? The time may come where it might actually be a true application of us, and where there may be some records of not just how people are successful in spiritual wars, but how successful people are in physical wars. I think of I think it was an older man last year who was carrying a sidearm in a church when a gunman came into the church and began to open fire. And without care for his own life and immediately knowing what it was going to take to stop this man, pulled his sidearm and killed the gunman that was threatening the lives of the people in his congregation. That's courage. That doesn't mean he wasn't scared, but that's courage. How many men do we have like that anymore that wouldn't cower in fear, that would protect their families, that would even use power to resist something in the face of such obvious evil? There's a lot of issues, I think, with this idea of the manly man, the man who will use force when necessary. And a lot of those issues are rooted in this concept of toxic masculinity, which I'm sure all of you have heard about. Now, toxic masculinity itself, if you look at kind of the overarching idea of what it espouses, you think, yeah, there's some decent points about that. That, you know, maybe you go to a Texas Roadhouse and there's a motorcycle gang there. And those guys are thinking that they're the manliest men on the planet, and they're loud and they're obnoxious and they swear and they're drunk. That would probably be a good example of worldly toxic masculinity. That's not true masculinity. That is something that's toxic. Okay. Unfortunately, toxic masculinity has come to mean really just masculinity at all. And so a lot of the men that I grew up looking up to are now suddenly toxic in society because they make decisions for their family, because they don't allow certain things in their household, because they don't allow their boys to dress in a way that passes them off as feminine. That's toxic today instead of masculine, and that's a problem. What I'm noticing, and what I often talk to my cousin Benjamin about, is toxic masculinity, or at least the idea of it, in Christianity. And suddenly we have these Christian men who are soft-handed, and that's an analogy, that's not like literally speaking, but are not hardworking, are not outspoken when they need to be, and who tend to call out those men in churches and in society who are that way, and make them feel like they're inferior because they're not in touch with their emotional side and because they don't care enough. That is a major problem within Christian circles that I have seen, especially of people that are my age. And I would challenge each of you to look for that and not allow it to creep into the lives of your children or into your own life, because it is very easy to get pressured into saying or thinking a certain way due to these men. These are men who rely on their emotions. They're men, in the words of Joel Dubois, who some of you remember, as my teen class teacher, one of the many things that I remember that he always said was that a man runs to the problem. And he said that over and over to us teen men. A man runs to the problem. He sees a problem, he runs to it because he's going to solve it. And that doesn't mean he's flamboyant and he's prideful in the way that he approaches it, but he runs to the problem to find a solution. We have men today who cannot do that. They actually physically do not have the ability. They do not have the intestinal fortitude to look at a problem and go, I need to go solve that right now. I see that all the time in the discipline of kids. Without getting too personal and giving you specific examples, there are members of my family who I can hardly stand to be around as men because they refuse to run to the problem when their kids are the problem. Please hold me accountable when this little guy is born. Because Jamie and I have determined that he will not be a problem in this church and he will not be a problem anywhere. And it is so easy for these emotional, spineless Christian men to say, oh, yeah, I'll spank him another time, or, you know, it's really not that bad. He's just being a kid. Maybe he doesn't understand what he's doing. Let me tell you something. Spanking is how he understands. We have men who cannot run to the problem. They can't do that. We have men who will not do it, men that have the ability but won't. And how frustrating is that to see? They can identify a problem, but they're not willing to do it. They have the ability to do something, but they won't solve the problem. Think about how prevalent that is in churches. When you think, man, this really needs done around here. Well, so-and-so could do it. He has a lot of experience in this. He's really good at solving problems like this, but where is he when he needs to be found? He will not run to the problem. We have a bunch of Christians who are social media warriors. And this has provided a platform for Christians who are talkers instead of doers. And I have written down here, a man does the job, a boy talks about it. How many men do we have in society today, in Christianity today, that take care of the problem, that do the job? Let's go back to some passages here. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 4. And then if you would also turn to 1 Corinthians 16, 4, 13 through 14. So 1 Samuel 4, 6 through 10. And 1 Corinthians 16, 13 through 14. So 1 Samuel 4, 6 through 10. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the ark of the Lord was coming to the camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God is coming to the camp." And they said, "Woe unto us, for there hath not been such a thing heretofore. Woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty men? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians in the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight." And the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten. So this is actually an enemy of Israel that is responding to the knowledge and this noise that's in the camp of the Israelites as these armies camp against each other, that the Ark of the Covenant has been there. And what we see in the result is that Israel's response to the Ark of the Lord being brought is a purely emotional one. Because if they had truly had the faith to defeat the Philistines, God would have given them the victory as he had promised their fathers so many years ago before they even went into the land of Canaan. But the Philistines, on the other hand, what did they do? That's not about emotion. We could be scared right now because of this great shout we heard in the Israelite camp. Be a man. Be a man and stand up against these Hebrews. And they talk about all these things. So this is the enemy of Israel who's quitting themselves, who's becoming a man in the face of this, and this is contrasted to that emotional response of the Israelites. So 1 Corinthians 16, 13 and 14. This is the second occurrence in the Bible where it uses the phrase, quit you like man, which basically just means act like a man. Watch ye, stand fast in the faith. Quit you like men, be strong. Let all your things be done with charity or love. But verse 13 is where I really want our emphasis to be. Of course, let everything being done in love, and Pastor has talked about how that looks in a lot of different situations. Sometimes that looks like you're being really hard on somebody, doesn't it? And if you grew up with a good father figure, you know exactly what that looks like. Where he's hard on you, but it's done out of love. I think that's what this passage is talking about. Watch ye stand fast in the faith, act like a man, and be strong. Don't let your emotions rule you, but make sure that everything you do is done out of love. So that's actually all introduction, but the other 2 points are short. So the first thing I want to talk about in the actual body of this is the fake fragility of Jesus and how Jesus is broadcast by a lot of contemporary Christians. First of all, Jesus was not a pretty boy. And I use that very reverently in contrasting him against a lot of the ways in which Christian men come across today. How many of you have noticed that? Let me tell you something. I went to Bob Jones several years ago, and I continually age myself in talking about how long ago it was. And Dave, I'm not sure if you experienced this when you were at Bob Jones, but one of the pervasive problems among men at that school was the fact that they were really pretty boys. And especially coming from Kansas, I told you I wasn't going to do the farming analogy, but especially coming from Kansas, when you go from one environment to another environment, you go, how in the world were you guys raised? And they're so emotional. They need help through every little sin in their life. And they have to tell everybody about everything. They have no stomach to handle their own issues. And there were men constantly going to prayer leaders and to hall leaders and to dorm supervisors and talking to them over and over and over with no solution, really. Okay, they just continually had these problems, not solving the sin in their life. That's a problem. So if you need to broadcast your sin to get accountability for it, you're not handling it like a man handles it. Okay? And that doesn't mean that accountability is wrong. All right, but accountability in certain circles and tight circles, that's where that should take place. And I understand that a lot of times these boys, especially at Bob Jones, didn't have the opportunity to go to their father for accountability, but that's where that should start. And it should probably start there and then probably go to their pastor or another trusted man that they have in their local church, and probably from there go to a prayer leader or somebody like that. But what I saw was not people who were genuinely trying to solve those issues, but were simply using it as a demonstration of how much they were working on themselves as Christians. Oh, I've got to go talk to the dorm soup about such and such of a sin that I have. Why are you telling me that? Why do I need to know? I understand that you have that issue. Keep it personally and solve it. You shouldn't be going there week after week after week and saying, oh, I still struggle with such and such. Why? Why? You need somebody to pat you on the back and tell you that you're doing a good job, and then you just go right back to doing the exact same thing. That's what you're doing. Jesus wasn't like that. Jesus was not that fragile person who couldn't handle his own problems. He didn't need constant accountability because he in and of himself was sufficient. And I understand he was the Son of God and he was a perfect example of what we should be as men. But Jesus did not pursue and broadcast issues that he had come up in his life. It's supposed that Jesus' father, Joseph, died because he's not mentioned throughout his adult life. Anywhere in his messages do we find Jesus emotionally tampering with the hearts of the people that he's preaching to, saying, I lost a father. I know how hard it is. No, he dealt with that. He dealt with it, and he struggled, I'm sure, but he dealt with it, okay, in a perfect and righteous way. And that's the example that we should use. So he was a carpenter. Here's somebody who works with his hands. somebody who's a physical laborer. He didn't stand out in appearance. Right? In the Garden of Gethsemane, when Judas is coming with the Roman soldiers and the leaders of the Jewish community of the day, he has to point out which one's Jesus. Okay? Jesus didn't do anything to make himself stand out in fashion or overly worry about his appearance to the point where you could go, whew, that's the prophet that everybody's talking about. Okay, the book of Isaiah talks about that. He's not comely, right? We don't look upon him and find anything necessarily that's beautiful, that's attractive. And there's a reason for that. Part of it is the fact that it's a masculine approach. Okay? And saying, I don't need that flamboyant, look at me type of personality. I'm going to let my actions speak for myself. And that's truly how Jesus gained fame in his ministry. If you look at Jesus's ministry, he speaks boldly. He reprimands the Pharisees in Matthew 23. That's the passage where he says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. He points them out in a group and says, you guys are doing the wrong thing. If you don't think that that's the action of a man, then you're wrong. That's what a man does. And this is a continual issue that he always saw with the Pharisees. This isn't just something that he decided to pick on that day. He had had enough. He said, you're misleading the people of God because you're hypocrites. And here's all the ways. And we don't have time to read the whole passage, but verse after verse, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. He reprimands his own disciples. He calls Peter Satan. Get thee behind me, Satan. In seeing the spirit of evil in him when he tries to convince him not to give himself on the cross for us. He reprimands his disciples, I believe it's James and John, when they ask him to call fire from heaven on a Samaritan city that does not accept him. He says, no, that's not what this is about. How dare you even mention something like that? That is not the power of God that's in you. Okay? That is you wanting to do something for selfish reasons. Jesus acting boldly. One of my favorite passages that I will have you guys turn to is John 2, 13 through 17. John 2, 13 through 17 says, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple and the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overthrew the tables and said unto them that sold doves, hey, guys, could you please leave? Just, you know, nice, quiet voice. No! He says, take these things hence. Make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. And I believe firmly that he said it loud and boldly and in anger, righteous anger. Because he was so upset about what he saw taking place in the temple. How many of you, when you would see an issue so grievous in your own church, would have the spirit of Jesus in approaching that and saying, no, we're not doing that. That is wrong. You guys need to straighten up. Would you do that? If you were in a deacon's meeting and they were talking about something that was not glorifying to God, that happens in churches all the time. My dad has plenty of stories, not from Westside, but from other churches where he served in leadership positions, where they were doing things and spending people's money in ways that they should not have spent it, in a wrong way. And somebody had to get up and say, no, that's not going to happen. And you need to know why it's not going to happen. All right? Jesus did pick his battles because he didn't approach everyone this way. Okay? But there are circumstances when you have to speak in that way. And so boldly and so outright that people have to take attention. They have to pay attention to what it is that you're saying. And those of you that are fathers, I'm sure you know exactly what that sounds like. But when you see something that's wrong, It has to be addressed, especially when it's something as wrong as this. Let's talk about the fake fragility of the father figure. One thing that I've noticed in media today is that if you guys watch, some of you may mute all of your commercials, that's probably a good idea. But if you watch commercials, who's always the buffoon, the idiot in the commercial? It's always the dad or the husband who doesn't know how to do something, who's a total idiot. One show that my dad liked to watch was Home Improvement. And that's a pretty good show. A lot of funny situations that Tim Taylor gets himself into. But if you're familiar with that show, he's a tool man, right? And he kind of embodies that manly sort of, you know, he's into cars and sports and all those things. And so a lot of it is the shortcomings of his emotional kind of unattachment with his wife and struggling through that, as a lot of men are. They're less emotional than their wives, and so there's issues that come about. And that show is funny, but it's also kind of poking fun at what true masculinity is. Is there anything wrong with the things that Tim Taylor is interested in, and the tools, and those things? And yet it almost is a mockery of those types of things, and that a man should be more in touch with his feminine side. And the great thing about that show is it pokes fun at that idea too. But we have this idea in media suddenly that the men are just kind of these, you know, almost the idealistic football player that, you know, gets straight D's but can run through a brick wall. Like, he's just kind of this big oaf caveman type person who me no know how to work dishwasher like type thing. And that's mocking man's leadership in the household. The Bible emphasizes men and fathers in 1 Corinthians 13:11. You can turn there if you'd like to, but this is not just talking about fathers, it's talking about mature Christians. It says, put away childish things. You know, the way in which men are portrayed a lot of times is immature. That the things that they pursue are kind of pointless. Their hobbies are secondary to whatever their children or their wives are pursuing. And yes, sometimes men need to be able to put away childish things. And sometimes some of those things are generally labeled as masculine. But how many times do we as Christians realize that putting away childish things grows you up into manhood? And some of those childish things that are put away is that buffoonery, is that type of comical approach to life that I don't know how to do this, I'm just going to leave it to my wife. That's childish. Okay? That's an attitude of a boy who's always been reliant on his mom or his dad to do things for him. And yet that's what the media portrays men as. People who rely on others for their own needs and knowing how to do certain things. That's wrong. And if we put away childish things, as Paul encourages the Corinthians, then those things are not going to take place. And that masculinity that comes across as this ignorant person, that's not going to show through. It's going to be all of the traits that we've already talked about and we've seen in Jesus and the other men of God. Many New Testament verses talk about men as leader of the homes, wives submitting to their husbands. But lastly, I want to talk about the fake fragility of the saint. And this is kind of where you apply it to more than just the men that are here in this room. Christians themselves should be strong. I want everybody to turn to Proverbs 24:10. This is my life verse, and I'm sure after reading it, a lot of you will understand why. It's very, very simple, as a lot of the verses in Proverbs are. That's one of the reasons Proverbs is one of my favorite books, because you read it and you just get a whole lot of advice. The words are not minced. Flowery language is kind of done away with. And in Proverbs 24:10, it says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. Then it moves on to the next piece of advice that Solomon has for us. If you faint in the day of adversity, then your strength is small, period. And this goes to men and women. But as this challenge is really targeted at men, listen, there's a lot of issues that come up through marriage. There's a lot of issues that I'm going to find myself in raising our son. There are going to be a lot of days of adversity for me yet ahead. And there's a lot of days of adversity for each one of you. Listen, if you faint in that day, if you're not equipped for that task, then your strength is small. What a challenge from the book of Proverbs. Okay, that cuts to my heart just the same way as my dad's teasing did in asking me if I needed a man to do whatever job I was doing. Your strength is small. I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that Christian man. Because this is the biblical point of view where God sends a trial into my life and he says, your strength is small. You couldn't handle it. I needed a man for this. And I'm going to have to go somewhere else. It's things like that that would keep me up at night if I knew all the times that I failed God as a man. How long are you going to tolerate sin in your life? How long are you going to allow yourself to be the person that faints in the day of adversity? How long are you going to tolerate sin in a church? Sin that you know is taking place. Hopefully not here at Westside. But not all of us may be members here. You know, we have had a lot of people move over the last 25 years of Westside Baptist. We've had people move on for various reasons. What's going to happen when you're even just with other Christian friends outside of Westside? How long are you going to tolerate that? How long are we going to tolerate, as Christian men, sin in the world and not call it out for what it is? June is Pride Month, which I'm sure a lot of you know by every single business changing their logo. That's sin. That's sin. And if I have, and I hope if you guys are put in the same situation, if anyone forces that on you and corners you on that, be like Jesus. Be like these mighty men in the Old Testament, even in a situation that's that simple, where you're not opposed by a force of Philistines numbering the hundreds or the thousands, and say, no, that's a sin. You're not going to pin anything on me over this. And if you want to broadcast that, then you're going to have to get around me as a person, as a Christian. Because it's not going to be accepted where I work and where I am. Are we willing to do that? To let people know? Most of the time in the United States, you're going to be okay with that. Okay, people are relatively still accepting of those opinions. And that's what I found even as a teacher. People understand. Some people may not, and some people really may try to get you to admit something that's wrong. Don't give in, right? And for the men that are in this room, continue doing what you're doing. Each one of you in your own way has been a fantastic example just to me, and I'm sure you've been encouraging to all the other men in this room. Continue doing what you're doing, and don't let anybody throw you off course. If you faint in the day of adversity, then your strength is small. Don't let God be able to say that about you.